All right. So thank you for having me here today, and thanks, Oscar, for being so flexible when it became clear that Richard couldn't make it. I am delighted to be here to talk to you about the effects of climate change on phenology and how those effects can change ecological relationships. We are going to take sort of a turn here to, I would say, slightly more subtle changes, effects of climate change, and also to wild systems. So I'm going to be focusing mostly on the effects of climate change on plants and animals in Concord, Massachusetts, in wild temperate ecosystems. And my hope is that even if you do not study wild systems, that there are some elements of the methodology that we've been using to study the effects of climate change that could be applied to the system or the taxon that you work on. So I'd like to start with this figure showing temperature data from Blue Hill Observatory in Massachusetts. We've got temperature on the y-axis and time on the x-axis, and you can see that temperature is increasing in Massachusetts. So just to set the stage, there's been about an increase of 2.5 degrees Celsius in the last 150 years in Concord, Massachusetts, and at Blue Hill. And so our lab has been focused, before I arrived at the Premac lab, they've been focused on looking at the effects of warming temperatures primarily, but also an increased spring temperature variability on plants and animals in Concord, Massachusetts. So when we talk about the effects of warming temperatures and climate change on biological communities, there are three different key biological indicators that we look for. The one that I'll be really focusing on today is phenology, so the timing of seasonal biological events. In spring, that looks like flowering and leafing out of plants, its emergence and flight times of insects and arrivals of migratory birds. In autumn, which is my focus, and I'll touch on this later, we see those events mirrored by leaf color change and leaf drop. We see insect diapause in the fall and bird departures in the autumn. So changes in phenology can have really drastic implications for growing season lengths and the number of, say, generations of insects, particularly insect pests, that can occur in a year. We also look for changes in species distribution. So I believe Charlie Willis will be talking about changing distributions later today. I won't touch on that so much. There are many species that are moving sort of poleward and upward in elevation in response to changing temperatures. And then we see indirect effects on abundance. So as those growing seasons expand and breeding seasons expand, we can see changes in abundance of insects, of plants, and also of birds. So the approach that I'll be focusing on today that we've been using to look at the effects of climate change in Concord, Massachusetts, is the use of historical records. So we have, the Premac lab has been working on identifying historical records, and then matching those historical records to current observations to look at longer-term changes in phenology. So rather than conducting purely conducting experiments, which can sometimes overestimate the effects of warming on phenology changes, or starting a 20-year long-term study today, we can use these historical records to go back in time and look at timing of spring events in particular. We have a number of historical records we can use. We've got photographs. I'll touch on that briefly. We can use the field notes of natural historians. We have museum specimens of plants and herbaria, as well as insects, and we have other stored samples, including soil and seed samples that can be used. So we mostly use photographs to exhibit the effects of climate change for climate change publicity. So you can see this this is Lowell Cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts, and on May 30th of 1868, you can see that the deciduous species were largely still dormant twigs. There was no leaf out. But if you compare that to May 30th of 2005, All of these trees have fully leafed out. And so that serves as sort of a jumping off point for examining what those phenological changes are, the strength of those phenological changes, and how they vary by species. So a lot of what my advisor has been working on in the last 10 years is working with the field notes of Henry David Thoreau. I don't know if anyone saw the New Yorker article about Henry David Thoreau. Whatever you feel about Henry David Thoreau's personality, there is no arguing that he was a fantastic naturalist. And so we've been using Henry David Thoreau's field notes that he took from 1851 to 1858, and he really recorded very thoroughly leafing out times and flowering times of common species across Concord. And so you can see here that he has pretty terrible handwriting, but this was May 14th, so you can see the 14 there, and then this was highbush blueberry, or Vaccinium corymbosum, and so that flowered on May 14th of 1855, and we can compare that to current observations. 2012 was an extremely warm spring, and we saw highbush blueberry flower on April 1st of that year, so almost 6 weeks earlier than in Thoreau's time. Thoreau inspired Alfred Hosmer, another naturalist from Concord, to also collect observations on flowering times and to also look at abundance of species across Concord. And if we plot these dates, so mean flowering dates, mean first flowering dates, over time, you can see that in present day, we have plants flowering on average about 10 days earlier than in Thoreau's time. But of course, we're really interested in the effect of those rising spring temperatures on the first flowering dates in Concord. And so if we plot the mean spring temperature, and each of these is a year, and we look at mean first flowering date on the y-axis, you can see that this is a pretty tight relationship, that as temperatures increase, the mean first flowering date advances. And these two extremely warm years, 2010 and 2012, did indeed result in extremely early mean flowering times. And that has effects on biodiversity, so there are conservation implications to these changes in phenology. So in Concord, about 27% of the species that Alfred Hosmer saw are now locally extinct. And this is sort of surprising because Concord, most of this loss has happened in the last 40 or 50 years, and Concord has a lot of protected area. But what Charlie Willis and others found is that the least responsive species, so there's a connection between the species that are lost and the species, how strongly they're responding to spring temperature. So the species that are responding the least, that are least capable of tracking those temperature changes, seem to be the species that are in the greatest decline. So we also have used medium specimens. I'm going to turn to leafing out times now. But we've used herbarium specimens from particularly the Harvard Herbaria and other herbaria around New England. Luckily, a lot of them are becoming digitized right now through several different projects. But we looked at specimens with young leaves, so this very sort of narrow window of time when twigs were leafing out in the past, and we can get information back to the early 1800s through these herbarium specimens and look at the timing of spring leaf out. We found that trees are leafing out on average about 0.4 days per decade earlier, and that they're responsive to temperature. So there's about a 2.7 day shift earlier in leafing out per degree Celsius. To round out our sort of taxonomic understanding of the possible implications for climate change and phenology shifts, we wanted to look at more than just plants. So we've been working with the Manomet Bird Observatory in Plymouth, Massachusetts, to use long-term bird banding records. They've been banding birds since the late 1960s, and we looked at mean arrival dates in the spring. And what we found is that birds are not as responsive to spring temperatures in their arrival location, in their spring location, than a lot of these plants that are spending the spring in those climates. So birds, in particular, birds that are coming from the tropics, have a very poor ability to anticipate temperature changes in their spring breeding ground, if you can imagine. But that birds that are short-distance migrants and are coming from climates that are more similar to their breeding grounds, they're better able to track those changes. But on average, we see about a one-day shift per degree Celsius for all of the common migrants coming through Manomet. And of course, if we're looking at plants and we're looking at birds, we're really interested in what's happening to wild insect communities. And in the context of the effects of climate change on wild communities and temperate ecosystems, insects really are the missing link. We have more studies on plants and birds, and we're really missing information on how insects, wild insects, are changing. So Caroline Polgar led a study on Lycaenid butterflies in Massachusetts. She used citizen science data from the Massachusetts Butterfly Club, as well as looking at museum specimens of butterflies, and found that for elfins, there's about a six-day shift earlier per degree Celsius in flight time, and for hair streaks, about a three-day per degree Celsius shift earlier. So if we put all of those together, you can see that for flowering, leafing, and insect sightings, that there's between 3 and 5 days earlier per degree Celsius shift, and that birds are sort of the outlier here, and that some of them are actually arriving later in warmer years. And when we start to think about the implications of this for interactions, it's really important to note how much variation there is. So these are mean dates for what we know about these taxa and these events. And so if we're looking at whether birds arriving late will miss the peak of insect availability, we really have to know which insects those birds are eating and what birds we're talking about. So this is the next step of, we've looked at these taxa really broadly, and now it's time to hone in as much as we can on particular species interactions. But I did want to point out that while Henry David Thoreau did not have climate change on the brain, he was really acutely aware of these interactions, and I think today would be really would be aware of how climate change is affecting the interactions that he was observing. So he wrote in his journal in 1852, "Insects and the smaller animals follow vegetation. The greater or less abundance of food determines migrations. If the buds are deceived and suffer from frost, then are the birds." So we're still following in Henry David Thoreau's sort of naturalist footsteps as we look to wild systems to figure out what the important questions are in the context of the effects of climate change on phenology shifts. So we've looked into the past, and now we're sort of looking to the future. This is from the 2007 IPCC report, and as many of you know, we are really on track for some of those more intense forecasts of temperature change by the year 2100. And often we talk about how, so Massachusetts, in the time that my advisor was growing up in Massachusetts, he knows this time in Massachusetts. I'm not so familiar with it. That we're soon, by the end of this century, going to see a Massachusetts that looks more like the climate of South Carolina. And so we really have to start predicting what we expect to see next in Massachusetts, not just what we've seen in the past. And so we've started to supplement some of these historical observations compared with current observations with experiments to see what some of the implications of future climate change might be. And one thing that I haven't really talked about is the effect of that increased temperature variability and warmer temperatures on on frost damage of young leaves. So as as temperatures in the spring get warmer and leaves are unfolding earlier in the season, there's a bigger window for frost damage for those young leaves, those early leafing species. And so we wanted to see, we collected earlier last year dormant twigs in the field, we forced leaf out in the lab, and then we subjected them to several different freezing conditions to simulate a light frost, a moderate frost, and a hard frost. We found in the hard frost, just about everything died. In the light frost, just about everything survived. And the moderate frost really produced a lot of variation between species. In particular, we found that native shrubs are far less frost tolerant than invasive shrubs. And so we might expect that as these species leaf out earlier in the future and we see increased frost damage to increased frost exposure to some of these plants, that this might produce an additional advantage for these invasive species. So I want to turn next to the opportunities in this field. So as Oscar mentioned, I'm particularly interested in autumn phenology. It is relatively neglected compared to spring in the literature, but that these are really important events. So we're seeing increased interest in the timing of leaf senescence, which is driven by many more factors than temperature alone. So we're seeing a larger impact of photoperiod, of frost in the fall, of precipitation, and more on leaf senescence. We also are looking at fruit ripening dates, at autumn bird responses, so autumn departure dates, and then also at insect diapause and insect flight times of butterflies, using that Massachusetts Butterfly Club data set again. And I'm particularly interested in the interaction between migratory birds and fruiting phenology. So one thing that we've found from looking at herbarium records of native and non-native invasive fruiting, fleshy-fruited species, is that on average, the native species that produce fleshy fruits in New England fruit earlier than by about 2 weeks than the invasive species. We also know from those banding records from Manomet that many birds, such as this hermit thrush, are migrating through later over time and in response to warmer autumn temperatures. And so what this could create is some disconnect between these migratory birds that are departing later and the native fruits that they usually consume earlier in the season. So stay tuned for more information about that. And then there are a lot of opportunities in phenology that we're not looking at. So pest phenology and abundance, there is as emergence dates get earlier and diapause dates get later, there's an increased growing season and breeding season for additional generations of many insect pests and invasive species. And this creates an added window, sort of a bonus period of time for those species to inflict damage on wild species and crops. There's been recent work done looking at the synchrony between above and below ground phenology, and it turns out they are not very well synchronized at all. And so looking at the phenology of soil respiration is a wide open opportunity for future research in this area. We also still don't know much about the specifics of the potential for ecological mismatch as a result of different shifts among interacting species in response to warming temperatures and other climate changes. We could be using agroecosystems as models for these ecological mismatches. So often these wild communities are extremely diverse. They have there are a lot of generalists in these communities. And it's possible that agricultural systems could be used as an opportunity to simplify some of those relationships within the research context. And then the last thing that I wanted to touch on is that a lot of these phenological shifts create opportunities to communicate climate change with the public. I don't know if anyone attended the second keynote speech last night that about communicating our science with the public. And I think this is a really great opportunity as we sort of show that that climate change is leading to some troubling separations of interacting species. This has been really an area that the press has been really interested in. So we've had a recent article published in New Scientist about the fall of fall, but mostly about how autumn is changing. And it's changing as a result of climate change and not getting a lot of attention. We've been talking to school groups, so this is my advisor, Richard Premack, talking to a bunch of fourth graders about climate change and Henry David Thoreau. The work of the Premack Lab was recently featured in an HBO special for kids. And then my advisor recently wrote a book about the work that that the Premack Lab and others, many collaborators, have been doing in Concord. So to communicate some of that research to the public. So I wanted to say thank you again for having me in lieu of Dr. Premack, and to acknowledge all of the people who contributed to this research. I sort of jumped in on the end of this some of this research that I presented today, but I'm very proud to be part of that community. So thank you very much.
The work with Thoreau, and you mentioned a lot of positive things, but what are some limitations that you see with working with that kind of data or information?
Yeah. I think one of the limitations is Thoreau recorded a lot of details about where he saw different species and his methodology, but obviously we can't communicate with Thoreau. We can't know exactly what his methods are beyond what he recorded. I mean, he did write definitions for flowering and for leaf out that we were able to, that the lab was able to follow up on and to track those individuals in the same, or those species in the same places where Thoreau saw them. There's been a lot of other changes in Concord since Thoreau's time, so development, which some of the warming in Concord has occurred as a result of the urban heat island there. His handwriting seemed like an initial limitation, but they seem to get past that. It would be great if we had more years of data from Thoreau's time, so instead of the sort of five-year span that we have for most species. They really limited the data set to the species that they had a good span of time for from Thoreau's time. It's very fortunate that Alfred Hosmer collected his observations soon after Thoreau, so we have some sort of middle, a separate data set to incorporate into that analysis for some of the leafing out studies that we've done with Thoreau's observations. We did not have the benefit of Alfred Hosmer's observations, and so there's sort of a wide gap there between those two sets of observations. But the hope is that we can continue the observations that we're making in Concord now with both flowering and leaf out to follow up on Thoreau's observations and really increase that data set. It's the challenge with using any citizen science data set, too.
when we calculate the rate of change in days per degree, we are assuming that 100% of the variation is simple. So would you comment on bias?
Sure. So why we've focused on temperature for these analyses and in lieu of incorporating more drivers. So for a lot of the, we're not particularly water limited in spring in Massachusetts. And so when we have incorporated precipitation or soil moisture, when we've had soil moisture to incorporate, we have not seen very strong effects of precipitation. For the leaf out data, we have looked at other drivers. So we know that leaf out is generally a combination of photo period, of winter chilling requirements and of warming temperatures in spring, and those are the factors that drive leaf out. So we have done, we've started doing more work incorporating those as drivers in analyses and in experiments. So we've started doing experiments on winter chilling requirements, in particular because there's been some evidence lately of this relationship with temperature not being linear, so that in the future, as temperatures continue to warm, that there are some sort of physiological barriers that will cause some species not to leaf out earlier anymore, not to respond to temperature as strongly. So for instance, if they didn't receive a long enough winter chilling time, enough accumulated winter chilling units, or if they haven't reached their photoperiod requirements. And I can tell you one thing that we have found that sort of similar to the frost tolerance experiment is that for winter chilling requirements, the invasive shrubs of Concord have almost no winter chilling requirements. And so we would expect that as temperatures continue to warm, that invasive species will continue to respond, whereas some of those native species, both trees and shrubs that have stronger physiological constraints in the form of winter chilling requirements, and in some cases photoperiod requirements, that we may see a much slower, a much weaker response to future warming with those species.
I was actually going to ask a question along the lines of what you were saying at the end there, but so to keep going, it was a little bit counterintuitive to me that invasive, maybe this was just one particular case, but that invasive would be, more tolerant of cold temperatures. If you think with the big decline in cold temperatures, that would be facilitating invasive species were more sensitive. So I was just wondering if that's a general pattern.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that the frost tolerance stuff is in process, so I'm not sure that I can speak to that completely at this point. But I would say a lot of what we're thinking about the invasive species and both winter chilling requirements and frost tolerance at this point is that they're bet hedgers, so they seem to have really high plasticity, and part of the reason that they have done so well may be that these are the species with high plasticity that also have high frost tolerance. So we may be seeing the results of some of that selection already, but I'm not sure. That's a great question, and it's something that we'll certainly think about moving forward with now that we're thinking about frost tolerance in the future with these experiments.